Thanks for listening to Outcast World. You lock your front door, don't you? You wouldn't go out and leave the front door open. Well, that's essentially what you're doing when you're not using a VPN. Right now, your data is being tracked, stored, and sold by loads of people. For a lot of people that are listening to this show, that is not just annoying, it can also be very risky. NordVPN fixes it. It's fast, it's reliable, it's number one for consumers, and it takes less time to set up than ordering a takeaway. Outcast World listeners can get NordVPN for under £3 a month. That is up to 75% off. Just go to outcastworld.net. The link's at the top. Turn it on. Forget about it. Make yourself safer online with the number one NordVPN for under £3 a month at outcastworld.net.
On today's episode...
You can come into Britain from anywhere in the world and get diagnosed with HIV and get the retroviral drugs.
There's a moment in Matt Nadell's Oscar shortlisted documentary called Cashing Out where the whole sort of grotesque, I'll call it arithmetic of the AIDS crisis, lands in a kind of single transaction. It's a dying man selling his life insurance policy to an investor for a fraction of its face value. He gets enough cash to live out whatever time he had left at that point with some dignity. The investor waits, and when the man dies, the full payout lands. Thousands of queer people did exactly this, and a $1 billion industry grew around their deaths. Matt Nadell's film's been produced for The New Yorker, and it doesn't flinch from the moral tangle of it all. It's not straightforward. You'd like to think there were just good guys and bad guys, and then your dad's involved. It's a film about what happens when the state abandons people so completely that the free market steps in and it builds a business model out of them dying. And if you think that kind of political indifference to HIV belongs in the 1980s, then you haven't been listening to what's been going on in Britain recently. In a reform rally in April, Nigel Farage doubled down on a position that he first outlined in 2015 when he called for asylum seekers living with HIV to be banned from seeking treatment under the NHS. They just stopped treating them.
Here's a fact, and I'm sure the other people who will be mortified that I dare to talk about it. There are 7,000 diagnoses in this country every year for people who are HIV positive, which is not a good place for any of them to be, I know. But 60% of them are not British nationals. You can come into Britain from anywhere in the world and get diagnosed with HIV and get the retroviral drugs that cost up to £25,000 per year per patient. I know there are some horrible things happening.
His Scottish leader, Lord Offord, backed it up with a handful of anecdotes from a single GP and some cost figures that fell apart under the slightest bit of scrutiny. He said this is a national health service, not an international health service. The reality that he doesn't really understand or seem to care about is that the UK is closer than any country in the whole world to eradicating HIV transmissions. I think we can in part thank Wes Streeting for that. I won't repeat that. We've done it without a vaccine and without a cure because we treat everybody who needs it. Now, that isn't sentimentality. That's epidemiology. We learned a lot about that a few years ago, didn't we? Undetectable equals untransmittable. A person on effective HIV treatment just can't pass the virus on. It's not possible. And what makes the story of Cashing Out, this Oscar-nominated documentary, so urgently current is the signalling that under a reform government, the lives of people with HIV would once again become a line item to be weighed against the political headwinds. We've been here before. The queer community has buried enough people to know exactly where that road leads. Which is why I wanted to speak to Matt at home in New York about this film, his Oscar nomination, his father, and about the people who had to sell their own deaths to survive. This is Outcast World.
Queer politics.
When Farage says jump, Labour might say how high.
And it's not true. It's offering people false hope.
Sex.
Dating apps have become a breeding ground for the worst of human behaviours.
And culture.
What do you want, homie? We get together, we be simple. Simple. Be simple for me.
He will, like, go nosh himself off.
This is Outcast World.
Matt, first of all, congratulations on being shortlisted for an Oscar. That is a huge achievement, especially for a film like this, isn't it?
Thank you. Yes, I tend to think so too.
For those who don't know, Cashing Out is a documentary about an insurance system that allows investors to profit from the deaths of people with HIV and AIDS in the US in the 1980s and 90s, and about the human cost of a society where illness so often means financial ruin as well. Given all of that, Matt, why did you decide to make this film?
Well, the reason I made the film has changed over the course of working on it. I started making the film for a very particular reason, which was that I discovered that I had a personal connection to the subject matter. I had never heard of this strange industry before. But it was in 2020, and I was on a walk one day with my dad, because this was when, you know, we were sort of thinking about the possibility of a vaccine for COVID, but we hadn't seen one actually introduced yet. And I said to my dad sort of offhand, you know, I obviously really want them to develop a vaccine, but I can't help but feel sort of weird that these executives at pharmaceutical companies are going to make all this money off of a pandemic that has bankrupted a lot of my friends and devastated so many people. And my dad responded with this, like, he was like, "What do you mean?" It was very like defensive. And I was like, "Whoa, like, what do you mean? Like, are you good?" And that's when he told me, he was like, I think I need to tell you about something. And he told me that this industry had existed, called the viatical settlement industry, where people with AIDS, primarily gay men, who had been given 6 months or a year or 2 years to live, could sell their life insurance policies to investors, you know, get, say, 50, 60, 70% of their own death benefit to use up front while they're still alive. And when they die, the investor makes the rest as a profit. And he told me that he was one of those investors, meaning that my childhood was in part bankrolled by gay men dying of AIDS, which is especially horrifying to me as a gay man. And it sent me into a total spiral, as I'm sure you can imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was why I started making the film. But as I went through the process of making it, which I'm sure we'll get into, my sort of purpose, it changed a bit as I began meeting people whose lives had been shaped in some way by this industry, who had survived this horrifying time, and as the political realities of the United States changed with the return of Trump to power and the horrifying abandonment that we're seeing by our government of the healthcare needs of Americans right now. It just felt like, you know, this thing that I had started as a document of a family secret and a of history became something different before my eyes.
So it sounds like there was, probably talking to your father there, that was a kind of moment where this stopped being like a piece of research and it became something personal in many ways that you had to confront. I mean, this is the most personal of stories to you, isn't it? And complex.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And it's hard because, you know, I think of myself as sort of standing on the shoulders of the activists of that era. I mean, there are so many wins, political wins from that era that are the basis for my life. I mean, I take PrEP every morning to keep myself healthy. That wouldn't be possible without their activism. But also there's a level of recognition, a level of social justice that was won by the activists in that era, saying like queer people will not be relegated to the margins. We're having a real problem and need to be really paid attention to. So yeah, I mean, to think of myself as standing on their shoulders and then to learn that in some ways my life or my childhood had depended on those very people dying was, yeah, it was really, you know, kind of the only way to begin to process it was to start making a movie, I guess.
So on paper, when I was reading about the premise of your film, I thought I was immediately going to be disgusted at this as an industry. But after watching it all, I was left with a much different take on this viatical settlements industry. Your first instance is to think this is outrageous, but in the context of the system it exists in, it's much more, I think, nuanced than that sometimes, isn't it? Like, for people coming to this cold, could you explain how this sort of viatical settlement system worked?
Yes. So the first premise is somebody had a life insurance policy. In the US, that typically happens from your job. We get our health insurance from our jobs, and our jobs also provide us a set of other benefits. One of them oftentimes is life insurance. So you have a life insurance policy, and then you get sick, and a doctor tells you you have a year to live or 2 years to live. So there are lots of people who, you know, entered real financial ruin after getting a diagnosis like that. They were too sick to work, so they lost their jobs. Or maybe they did keep working, but the cost of medication or other costs associated with the illness were too much to bear. Or maybe, you know, their survival needs were met, but they were told that they had a year or 2 years to live and they wanted to go on that big vacation. They wanted to get that dream house, whatever it was. There were financial needs and desires that were unmet. So this industry emerges where you can sell your life insurance policy to an investor. They'll give you a cut of it to use while you're alive, quick upfront cash, and they're making a bet that you're going to die soon enough, and when you die, they will collect the full policy. So say I have a year to live and a $100,000 life insurance policy. Maybe an investor gives me $60,000 right now. I can go on that vacation or pay my rent or buy medication. I die in a year. The investor makes the other $40,000 as a profit. Less, you know, they had to pay to keep the policy in force.
And this was money that would have gone to their next of kin, which often I'm imagining they're no longer in touch with for a lot of people in that era.
That's right. Yeah. A lot of people, you know, it's not a queer people have always had less traditional family structures. So this idea of a next of kin also is a hard thing to even think about in this moment. I mean, lots of people would have maybe left the money to their lovers, but those lovers were sick too. Lots of times people have been rejected by their families. So, you know, why am I going to leave it to mom or dad or brother or sister who doesn't even want to talk to me? You know, this is a way for me to bring the value of this policy back to myself.
So how important, because we've just talked there about how it was the only way some people could pay medical bills, cover rent, or live without constant panic. Some people were on the streets until they weren't. So there were obvious upsides to this. How important was it for you to hold that reality alongside the obvious financial incentives for the investors? Because for anybody looking for good guys and bad guys in this story, I'm afraid that it's much more complex than that, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, I was initially sort of resistant to this nuance that you're alluding to. I wanted to tell the story of a bad industry and my bad dad.
I wanted to hear that story, but I didn't get that story when I watched it. I was flooded with the nuance, and the nuance is the American social security and healthcare system, isn't it?
That's right. Yes. I mean, because our social safety net is so frayed. I mean, I'll start with healthcare, right? It's a catch-22. To have health insurance, you need to have a job. And to have a job, you need to be well enough to work, which is to say you have to be well enough to afford to get sick. It's so backward. Yes, there are other ways of getting health insurance if you are disabled, but it's not. We don't have a universal or public healthcare system in the way other countries do. And our social safety net is really lackluster. Like, you know, you can be terminally ill and there are basic needs that there is no institution set up to help you meet. So, you know, in that context, if somebody says, look, you have this asset, a life insurance policy that isn't doing you any good when you're alive. And it's going to go to people who have disowned you. Or it could present some value to you right now. It's hard to sort of cross your arms morally and look at that and say, like, well, they should have said no. You know, oh, how exploitative. When the alternative, like you said, was destitution. So there were people who got real benefit out of this industry, who were able to meet those survival needs, who were able to realize dreams that they had in their final months. You know, that disgust that I felt initially, I think, is valid, but perhaps a bit misplaced. The disgust I feel now, I guess, is less at the industry and more at a system that created the conditions for the industry. You know, more at a country that is so every man for himself that you have to sort of take out an advance on your own death in order to live. I wish the U.S. were set up in such a way that there wouldn't have been such a market for this.
Well,
that
there wouldn't have been a need. In the UK, you know, or Europe, for example, people often don't realize that here in the UK, no, we have free healthcare. In France, there is a healthcare system across the whole of the European Union, across the whole of the developed world. There is a healthcare system and some sort of security in it, except for the mother of democracies, apparently, where there is nothing. There is a healthcare market. And I think that's this, as well as telling the story of those people, those survivors of AIDS. And I was in tears from the moment your film started, all the way through. A beautiful piece of work. But it's such an American story, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And you're right. I mean, this industry did not take off in Europe, in most other countries. It was a very American phenomenon. You know, the industry existed in other places, but as a sort of financial tool. You know, oh, somebody who already has a lot of money, who maybe wants to move it around through some, you know, financial sneakiness. But the thing we're describing of meeting survival needs, that is an American phenomenon. It is so, and that's what I think, when I talked at the beginning of our conversation about the purpose of the piece evolving, that's sort of what I began to notice. Like, this is a reflection of the kind of fundamental paradox of America, which, like you said, it's the mother of democracy and the richest country in the world, and yet a country where everybody has to be so sort of scrappy, even with their own survival. And, you know, this is an American solution to an American problem. You know, it's trying to use the market to hack dignity out of a market that's not designed to give it to you. And, you know, I hope in some ways that people walk away from the film understanding the human and moral cost of unchecked capitalism, that this is how people are forced to spend their time and brain power, even at the very end, just to have their needs met. That's not justice.
No. I feel like at the center of this film, as well as it being a great piece of work, is also kind of your own reckoning, isn't it? It's the discovery that your own father had been invested in these policies for the right reasons, and your comfortable childhood has been bankrolled by investment in these policies. Did you find yourself, with it being your father, one of the critical people in it, and I'm left kind of liking your dad, and I can understand why he would make them decisions in the context of that society. He wasn't doing them for the wrong reasons, as I felt as a viewer. But did you find yourself wanting to defend him and then having to sit with what that instinct maybe revealed?
Such a good question. I first wanted to roast him.
I'll bet, yeah.
Like, my first instinct when I just first started the project was like, how dare you? What are you doing? What are you talking about? You know? And then as I got deeper into it and I had people like Scott and Sean, two of the stars of the movie, talk to me about the value that this had brought into their lives and how badly they needed it and how badly so many people they loved needed it, then I started feeling like, oh shit, like maybe my dad actually did do something good here. and maybe I need to cut him some slack. It was a hard line to toe, especially because I love him, because he's my dad. You know, I didn't want to let him off easy. You know, this was a really important line of inquiry. But what helped is that my dad was game for that inquiry. He was not resistant to the line of questioning that I wanted to pursue. And he also wasn't, he didn't have any kind of, he didn't want to control the conclusion that I reached about this. He sort of was willing to put it all out there and say, look, you're going to land on this wherever you land on it, but I know what this did for people. I was there. I was on the phone with people. I was hearing what this did. And you know, yes, you're my son, but if you're a good documentary filmmaker, you're going to probably get to this too. So, the process also just gave me so much respect for the genuine bravery that people have when they volunteer to be in a documentary. I mean, here I was like, this is my dad. Like, I have a vested interest in like in being balanced and fair toward him. And, you know, I can only imagine how hard it would be to put your story in the hands of somebody who you don't trust as much as your son.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah. In many ways, your dad's an asset in this film. He gives you an insight. I don't think you'd have got that insight had it not been your dad. How many of them investors would have just come on and chatted? I don't know if they would they?
No, I think, and you know, I include some archive in the film of a couple who invested in these policies, and many of them, and then none of the people whose life insurance policies they bought died.
I saw that,
and they went on TV news, sort of raging, you know, so angry, filed a lawsuit, blah, 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 you know, and that footage ages very poorly. You know, it really looks
really
like a well-to-do straight couple angry that people didn't die on time for their retirement account to fill out, you know, like that just yikes, you know, and I was glad that they had the audacity to say it then.
All make sense to you then at that point, though, when you saw that? Was that the moment where the moral logic of the system becomes clearest? I feel like it is in some ways. People are not dying.
Yes. I think that's right. You know, that was the moment where it was like, look, you can put this in shiny humanitarian wrapping paper, but how do you respond when your investment does not pay off? Are you going to take that, you know, oh, okay, that was the risk we took, and at least people are living, we did something good here? Or are you going to get on NBC News and complain? You know, and I don't want to paint with too broad a brush. There were different kinds of investors. Some investors, I think, sort of saw this innovation in treatment for HIV, saw the life expectancies extending, and said sort of, look, every investment carries risk. I'm glad we were able to help these people. I'm not going to bother them anymore. I'm going to sort of forfeit this investment. But there were other people who didn't. And I think in some cases, you know, like this couple that went on TV, they had invested like their whole retirement in these policies. I mean, that's just like a bad investment decision. Yeah. Like, don't put everything in one type of investment. Like, you know, I think they're just mad at themselves. Like, they made a really bad investment decision and they're trying to blame some gay guys for living. Like, sorry, that's your fault.
Did that kind of change how you feel about the word investment? Because it really takes that word and does something else with it, doesn't it?
Good question. I mean, yes. I think, well, it just made me feel like it's really hard for things to be sort of about money. They're either about money or they are not about money. And like, again, this industry had this sort of humanitarian veneer. I think there are some people who entered it not really thinking about the money. They were like, look, if I made a profit, lovely, but I'm doing this to help some people. And there are people who said, I'm doing this for money. Like, it's 1992 and gay people dying of AIDS is a pretty sure bet. And I want my retirement tied to a pretty sure bet. For those people, it was about money. I just don't think that you can't be like, oh, I'm doing this 50% about money and 50% for humanitarian reasons. I just don't. I think money is a sort of poisoning force in a way. And if you start doing something kind of for money, that very quickly becomes the working logic.
Watching this now in an era of public fury at insurance companies and growing anger about healthcare inequality in the US, I feel the film feels uncomfortably current at times. So do you think cashing out helps explain why healthcare in America produces so much fear, rage, and moral confusion?
I hope it helps explain that. I think our government and our healthcare system have done a very good job of making it seem like this order of things is inevitable or natural. Like, oh, well, of course it's complicated. It's so expensive to provide for people's healthcare. And my hope is that cashing out lays out very plainly what is happening, which is that the American healthcare system treats human lives as either profit generators or profit saboteurs. And that arrangement, first of all, does not lead to the best health outcomes for people. But second of all, it means that some people are haves in the system and some people are have-nots. Scott and Sean are two people I mentioned who were able to benefit from the viatical settlement industry because they had life insurance policies to sell, because capitalism had sort of deemed their lives sufficiently valuable. But my film also includes somebody named Dee Dee Shambly, who's a Black trans woman in Atlanta who had been working as a sex worker. And because of that, she didn't have a life insurance policy to sell. So this whole moral question was inaccessible to her. And this idea that she wasn't sort of eligible for this kind of dignity because her life was not assigned the right type of capitalist value is really disturbing to me, and I think should be disturbing to everyone. So yes, I hope cashing out helps explain the fury, helps explain the anger, and helps just lay bare the logic of our healthcare system and our social safety net in America, which is a logic of profit and not a logic of care.
The film was made with The New Yorker, an incredible partnership, really. Do you feel like that gave their platform gave you audiences and sort of a bit of a blue tick to help elevate the documentary a little bit, as opposed to kind of just doing everything on your own?
Definitely. I think there is a legitimizing force there. You know, I want the film to feel in some ways like a long-form New Yorker story. Like, it's not trying to make you think or feel one thing, but it's taking you on a sort of winding intellectual moral journey and giving you the tools to make your own broader assessments. And I think when you start a film and it starts with the New Yorker logo, there's a way you sort of sit up in your seat and think like, okay, this is going to bring me on a kind of a journey, it's going to ask me to think deeply. And I wanted people to be primed to think deeply, you know? And I also think the film, it's kind of a big ask. I'm asking people to think about some heavy, heavy stuff. And I think in some ways what the New Yorker's logo and affiliation do is signal to people, look, this isn't going to be an easy 40 minutes, but it's worth your time.
This is a queer art culture, sometimes a bit political as a podcast, and your work sits, I think, firmly in that lineage. In 2023, you made Cannes Can't Stand, following Black trans women challenging Louisiana's crimes against nature by solicitation law. What would you say connected cashing out to that? And also, just to touch on something you were saying, I don't know if we got it at the start of the interview, the work you're doing now, kind of ad hoc when needs to be done regarding the obvious, I don't know how to describe it, immigration crackdown doesn't even do it justice. The secret police going door to door and carting people off with masks over their faces. Mm-hmm. What is the thing that connects all of this work?
Good question. I mean, I'm interested in stories about how people survive when very powerful institutions are conspiring against them. How do people band together and develop these sort of creative strategies to get around these powerful forces of destruction? You know, what's happening on the ground right now in the US with this, immigration crackdown or whatever you want to call it, it's horrifying. And we're seeing an incredibly, incredibly inspiring degree of organizing, of coordination, of response. And I look, in my storytelling, I look for accountability. I look to tell stories about justice and injustice. But I also, I look for stories of hope in humanity, not from things going well, but from how people respond to things going poorly. You know, I just, there's so much they can take from us, but they cannot take our humanity, and they cannot take the inconceivable power that exists when we come together around something. And I've seen in this moment in the US the first instance of that in quite a while, where when you see somebody executed in the street for exercising their right to protest the disappearance and abuse of neighbors, that crosses a line for a lot of people. And there is space for everyone in the response to that. Like, you don't have to be an activist, quote unquote. You don't need to be a front lines person. You don't need to be an organizer. Like, you can be a mutual aid person. You can be baking cookies or making food for the people who are on the protest lines. You can be a you can be a designer of the protest signs. There are all these ways, whatever your skill set is, whatever your disposition is, there are ways to plug yourself into the movement, into the response in this moment. And we're seeing that happen. Like, there's a sex shop in Minneapolis that has become a sort of hub for mutual aid. People are coming there for their basic necessities because they're afraid to go to the store. And we're seeing people come together in unlikely ways, form unlikely coalitions, and actually lean on each other as community. So, you know, that film Can't Stand that you mentioned, yes, it's about this horrible Louisiana law, but it's also about how a group of very disempowered Black trans women have come together and formed collective power to oppose this horrible law that's been used to try to put them down. And so, yeah, I mean, to the extent that you can put any sort of like unifying logic on my work, I think it's that. I'm interested in how people come together and find creative, genius ways to survive when the systems that are set up to hurt them are working at full force.
Filmmaking is an art form, isn't it? And do you think that there is a space in art and culture in this moment in America?
I think there has to be. I think, I think a lot about AIDS history, obviously. Yeah. And, you know, some people say that the AIDS movement was the last successful social movement, at least in the US.
Why? Because it got results. And apart, things are better than they were. Everyone's not dying anymore.
Yeah, I think so. And there was an incredible degree of coordination and organizing over a disparate group. I mean, yes, HIV was something that was affecting queer people, but it was also affecting drug users and it was affecting hemophiliacs. And, you know, there was a way that these, and within the queer community, as we know, like there's a lot of, there can be discord. I mean, there are the like leather jacketed, act up white gay men, but there was also a huge epidemic of like HIV among Black and brown people, especially in the American South. And so how can those groups come together around a shared goal? Anyway, part of that movement was a collective called Grand Fury, which was a group of artists making the striking visual material that was the ammunition for ACT UP's political, you know, public opinion fight. I think art is what can bring us back to the kind of fundamental humanity that is offended by what's happening right now. And I think that's part of what fascist governments want to do, is sort of alienate us from that humanity at our core and, you know, sort of drown it out. So we forget to be outraged. We forget how to feel the sort of deep offense of what's going on. And I think art has a way of just snapping us back into that. All kinds of art. I'm not just saying protest signs. I'm not just saying AIDS history movies. But if you can make somebody feel again, all the other feelings flood back. I mean, I'm a movie watcher. I love movies. And I often find myself going to the movies and crying. I mean, I cry at like almost every movie.
Same.
And yes, I'm crying about the movie, but it's like the movie has opened up the space for me to cry about whatever I needed to cry about. Yes. And that's the space I think art can open for people. Like, get people crying again, get people laughing again, get people in the same room again. Like, it brings us back to the part of ourself that feels and that can get numb too easily.
Yeah, totally, totally agree. Matt, finally, what's next? Can we expect to see some of your more recent work anytime soon, or is that kind of work in progress?
Yes, there's lots more coming down the pipeline. I love a complicated, strange queer history, so you have another one of those coming from me soon.
What's that?
Another short documentary. It's about the one of the founders of the early gay rights movement here in the U.S., an author who was credited and lauded for a while as the, quote, father of the gay rights movement, until just a few years before Stonewall, when he unexpectedly embraced conversion therapy and betrayed the movement that he had helped to create. Right. And the film sort of tries to figure out what happened to him through the perspective of his only son, who's now in his 80s. So that's sort of a, and it's really, I mean, I don't want to spoil it, but it's really a story about sort of how movements evolve and what we do with the kind of imperfect drafts that we work through as we get to kind of the version of things that feels most right. And I think it's also mostly a story about the power of self-hatred. You know, this is somebody who had this sort of brilliance to imagine a better world, but did not have the courage to live in it himself. He was born in 1913, and there were all these ideas he had internalized about what it means to be gay that, you know, it's hard to shake that stuff off.
To this day, I mean, people are still doing that, aren't they? You know?
Yeah. So that's, I think, it's another challenging watch that I hope says something important about, like, where the gay community sits right now and where we can work. I also have some interesting other work coming, or at least I think it's interesting, about other sort of unlikely forms of survival and resistance. You know, I'm interested in that across the board. As a gay man, I obviously gravitate toward queer stories, but there's so many fascinating ways that disempowered people grab their agency and their power back. And I have a couple stories about that bubbling right now.
Are you in New York, just for me to sign off? Or I was just going to say, presume you were. You are. Matt Nadell, thank you for joining us this Friday morning, taking time out in New York.
Thank you for having me. It's been such a pleasure to chat.
Queer politics, sex, and culture. Outcast World.
Stay with me. This is incredibly simple. If you've ever used Grindr, Googled something rather personal, or posted anything political, your data is already being tracked and sold. Think about that. A VPN can make you a lot safer. NordVPN takes about 2 minutes to set up, one click to turn on, and it just runs in the background. There's no effort after that. It's consistently voted number one across a load of metrics for consumers. It's fast, it's secure, and there's no drop-offs. Outcast World listeners can get up to 75% off NordVPN right now, which brings it down to under £3 a month. Go to outcastworld.net. Top of the page, tap the link, then you're done. Outcastworld.net for up to 75% off NordVPN.